From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, a foundation seeks to keep the children of inmates in school and help them go to college.
Out of those dropouts, 60% end up in jail. It's certainly cheaper to try to get these kids in school than it is to incarcerate them.
Plus, in a city known for its breweries, UWM's brewery is cooking up mobile apps.
We're focused on taking the, you know, the education, the learning that's happening in the classroom and applying it to a real-world sort of setting.
We'll hear the status of Door County's cherry crop, and we'll meet one of Door County's top winemakers. Lake Effect comes your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. WUWM's Project Milwaukee series has been examining the high rate of black male incarceration in the Milwaukee community, its causes, effects, and some ideas and programs aimed at reversing the trend. One of the other angles to the story in Milwaukee and elsewhere is the impact mass incarceration has on the families of those in prison. In the United States, some 2 million children are believed to have one or both parents behind bars. But a program in place in Milwaukee and a handful of other locations aims to have prisoners play a role in their children's future educational success. Percy Pitzer is a former prison warden from Texas and heads the Creative Corrections Education Foundation, which raises money for college scholarships benefiting the children of current and former inmates. And inmates are contributing to the fund. Pitzer joins us on the line from Texas. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Let me ask a really simple question to start with. Why you? Why is this your project?
Well, you know, I worked in prisons for nearly 30 years, and I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of kids go through the visiting room, and you could almost pick out who your next client was going to be. And I thought if I ever had the opportunity that I was going to try to do something to try to prevent that.
When did the light bulb go off for you that this could be a tool, this idea of helping some of these kids make it into higher education? When did that finally set in for you?
I've actually been looking at it for several years, but in the last couple of years I got more serious about it because I was in a better position to do it, actually financially, because my wife and I have put quite a bit of money in to get it started.
Did it ever strike you for the length of time that you were working in the prison system that you actually were considering the lives of the people outside the prison walls as much as you were considering, you know, as you were managing the lives of the people that are inside the prison walls?
Oh, I think I've always considered that. You know, families, when a person is incarcerated, a family does just as hard, if not harder time than the person that's incarcerated.
Well, and connect the dots for us. You know, what do you see scholarships and higher education for the children of inmates themselves and former inmates? What do you see them having to do with the broader issue of incarceration? Why does it strike you that you're so likely to see your next clients in the people that are visiting the family member in prison?
Well, you know, for an example, in the Milwaukee area, you know, I read some statistics that only 47% of the African-American young men graduate from high school. And out of those dropouts, 60% end up in jail. It's certainly cheaper to try to get these kids in school than it is to incarcerate them.
Do you feel, you know, when you're considering the children of inmates and ex-inmates, does it mean to some degree that you're conceding that something has been lost, some opportunity has been lost for the inmates themselves? I mean, this is not necessarily about improving their own odds after they get out of prison.
Well, you have to look at what we're doing as a nation. When I started in the prison system, America had approximately 200,000 people incarcerated. Today we have 2.3 million incarcerated. When I started working in the Bureau of Prisons, we had under 23,000 inmates incarcerated in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Today we got in excess of 219,000. I mean, at some point we have to say, what are we doing? You know, we have a there's an industry budget of around $65 billion a year. We have to take a look at that and see if we are, in fact, doing the right thing. And if I think if we took a serious look at it, we could probably find better ways of doing things.
What originally brought you to the Bureau of Prisons? Why was that the work that you chose to do?
Well, I had just got out of the military after serving 5.5 years, and it was available, and I went to work there. Actually, when I went to work, I knew very little about the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Your goal, your initial goal, wasn't to be a warden.
No, I don't think I could have ever visualized that at that time.
Did you see an ability to affect change in that role? I mean, even as the reality of prison life in America was changing, were you in a position where you could make something happen and, you know, work towards an end?
Probably not. I mean, when you're working in a prison, I mean, you operate programs and you try to improve the situation of individuals, but you also try to maintain a safe and secure environment for the inmates and the staff working there.
Why is it important to you that the people in prison play a role in supporting this scholarship fund?
Well, you know, contrary to popular belief, the overwhelming majority of inmates, even though they're incarcerated, still care about the children out there in the community. I don't think our society understands that. I've done many fundraisers with inmates over the years, and they get involved, and they do care about the community for the most part.
Well, and I know you've been to for example, the Milwaukee County House of Corrections, and what do you hear from inmates when you go into a place like that and make your case for what you're trying to do?
Well, I mean, they're, for the most part, very positive, and they get involved. Of course, some can't. I mean, we're not asking for much. We're asking that you consider donating the price of a candy bar a month. You know, considering we have 2.3 million people incarcerated, if we got 10% of them participating in this program, I mean, we could send hundreds of thousands of their children to school versus prison. You know, it's that old saying, it's cheaper to send a kid to Yale than it is to jail.
Well, and, you know, you're talking about the price of a candy bar a month, which, yeah, seems like, you know, a drop in the bucket to many of us. But as you say, you know, these are not people that are making a lot of money. Is there something symbolic about it as well? The idea that, you know, these inmates are actually trying to play a role in bettering life for the people on the other side of the walls?
Well, I don't know if it's symbolic or not. I think it's just, I guess my goal is to try to show society that even though these individuals are incarcerated, because they're incarcerated doesn't mean they still don't care about the children in the community.
The most recent data available, I think, shows there are 1.7 million children in this country with a parent behind bars. How much difference do you think you and this foundation can make?
Well, if we keep one kid from going to prison, I think it's a big difference. And I think we'll actually do better than that.
Did you ever, in your time as a warden and in creating this program, think to yourself that, you know, these people in prison, they made choices that got themselves in this position. Why should it be up to me to make things better for their kids?
Who is going to do that? Who knows both sides of the coin? Who has the ability to at least attempt to make that change in their life? You know, I am the system. I've worked in it for 30 years. I am in the community. I see what's going on out here. And I think that there could be a partnership. We have to do something because of the, you know, that number of incarceration keeps increasing, and so does the kids out there without a parent. And, I mean, we have to look at that. Or the incarceration rate is going to go much higher than it even is.
Are you already seeing effects from this? I guess what I don't know is how far along the foundation is in its work and whether people are already taking advantage of the money that's been raised.
We've only been going about 18 months, and we've given 41 $1,000 scholarships. We anticipate this year we'll probably give 100 scholarships because things are going much better. Right now we have the state of Texas, state of Ohio, state of New Mexico, and the Milwaukee House of Corrections on board with us. see that growing with other states in the country.
Well, Percy Pitzer, I thank you so much, and best of luck in your work.
Well, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Percy Pitzer is co-founder and president of the Creative Corrections Education Foundation, which raises money and awards scholarships to the children of current and former prison inmates. Pitzer is a retired prison warden who lives in Beaumont, Texas. Milwaukee is one of the locations the foundation serves. Our interview first aired in February. Later in the show, we'll speak with an award-winning Door County winemaker. But first, we will learn about a Milwaukee brewery. But its product won't end up in a can or a bottle or even a big ceramic mug. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. In the history of humankind, it's been a relatively short time since all our phones were wired to the wall and our ability to reach out and touch someone was limited. Today, not only can we call anyone from virtually anywhere, but for many of us, our phones have capabilities that were unheard of on a desktop computer a decade ago. And a Milwaukee laboratory is making a significant contribution to the landscape of mobile app development. What makes it especially impressive is that the developers, they're students. The so-called app brewery at UW-Milwaukee has been up and running for more than a year. Michael Hostad is director of web and mobile services at UWM, and he joined us in March to share the story of the app brewery. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me, Mitch. I appreciate it.
How does the work of the app brewery fit in with the overall educational mission of a place like UW-Milwaukee?
Well, I think kind of what makes the app brewery a little bit unique, although this is happening all over UWM, is that we're focused on taking the, you know, the education, the learning that's happening in the classroom and applying it to a real world sort of setting. So the app brewery partners with nonprofits, with local government, with startups, with researchers, of course, to give the students something that they can take their skills that they learned in the classroom and use it towards something real. And they actually get to interact with clients and learn the whole process. So it's, you know, become really that extension of the classroom into something that the students can really see how their skills can impact people, can affect an organization.
It's no longer theoretical when they walk into the brewery.
You know, we always Quinn Madsen, who's our lead developer and one of the instructors, always joked, you know, that a lot of programming classes, they're real apt to saying, well, let's create a mortgage calculator. And it's like, well, students, you know, what is a mortgage calculator and why do I have to understand amortization tables and all that sort of stuff? So we wanted to give them something that they could put to use and be applicable in a setting.
Well, I'll paint a picture of exactly what the lab is and what sorts of background they bring to that work.
Well, and that's the interesting thing. So we've got just to give you a little bit of background, we started a little over a year ago, last February, and we started with 4 students. We now have 12, and we've just gotten the go-ahead to hire up to 20. And it's students from all different backgrounds. We've got information studies students. We've got graphic design students. We've got a couple of communications students. And what we're trying to do is build sort of an agency feel to what we're doing. We want the students to understand that they are part of a team and that their skills interact with the skills of a designer or a developer or a project manager and get them to see how multiple people bring certain skills to working on one project and show them how to work together as a team to build whatever it is that they're building for our clients.
So these aren't just students that are rock stars in code that come to you.
Right, exactly. And I think that's what makes it unique is that we've got a lot of students from a lot of different backgrounds. And it's one of the things that we have to tell students, you know, you don't have to be a coder. You don't have to be that IT person. You can bring creativity to the table. You can bring organization and project management to the table. You can bring communications to the table. table. So we really try to bring in many different aspects to the brewery.
There are a lot of organizations, a lot of companies with a lot of needs in terms of apps. What kind of work is the right fit for your lab?
You know, we really have been focusing – we started our focus on the nonprofit sector. We've worked with a number of organizations who, without the help of the app brewery, frankly, probably wouldn't be able to do some of the things that they're doing with mobile. So that's been a good fit for us. But we really like to take on projects that excite the students, that give them something to really work towards and be excited about. Because after all, it's about the students. We want to give them unique opportunities, not only to broaden their skill set, but also try and get them connected into the community. And that's where the nonprofit world has really come into play. We've expanded into, of course, researchers at both UWM and now the Medical College of Wisconsin. And so that's providing another layer of interaction for students to get involved with.
Well, for most of us whose connection to this world comes through an icon on our mobile device, can you walk us through the app development process? What happens and how does it happen?
Well, it always starts with an idea. And it's amazing, you know, with the advent of mobile, some of the ideas that people are coming up with is just incredible. So we listen to the idea. We figure out whether that's applicable for a mobile device. And then we usually start with a storyboarding process. And we literally just go through screen by screen and figure out, okay, when the user opens the app, what are they going to see? And when they click on this, what are they going to see? And what's the app going to do? Once the storyboarding process is set and finalized and approved, then the students start with the design and development and go from there. So there's testing in there and then finally client approval and we go live.
Well, one of the things that you have done just in recent days is look at pitches for medical apps. And I imagine you see these kinds of pitches all the time. What's your sense for what the best ideas for apps have in common today and where do things go wrong?
You know, I think in terms of the best ideas, it really ranges. We're starting to see a lot more centered around health. That can be sort of a scary world because you're dealing with health data and privacy information. So, you know, apps are just really starting to get more and more comfortable with that. People starting to develop in that world. But I see that as being a big thing. And then, you know, potential pitfalls just center around the data piece. You know, is the data being pulled in correctly? Is it secure? And does the app function? You know, in the world of Android, there's how many different devices? And so testing for that can be problematic. And if you don't do all of your homework and all of your testing and release an app that only works for a handful of people, that's not exactly the place you want to be in.
Can you give us a sense for what some of the apps that have emerged through the work of the App Brewery are?
Sure. So, you know, we're working on a number right now. We're doing something for Visit Milwaukee where they can set up conferences. It's basically an app to promote the different conferences that are coming into town. So conferences can basically use the Visit Milwaukee app for their attendees to pull up the conference schedule, speaker bios, things like that. We've done something for the Sojourner Family Peace Center. We're working on an app for Historic Milwaukee that would allow you to take tours of the historic elements of Milwaukee and get a sort of a guided voice in your earbuds as you walk around the city. We're working on something for the Jewish Community Center. We're working with the Art Museum. Of course, our work with the Medical College. So the list, we've got about 30 active projects right now. So it keeps growing.
Well, and what strikes me about the app world is that years ago, we would be talking about software packages and you'd go to the computer store and you'd spend $59 or $99 or more on this box that came with a CD and an instruction manual. And with apps, you're paying a fraction of the cost for things that do an amazing array of tasks. How is the economic model allowing for the kind of innovation for places like the App Brewery? How are you able to accomplish that sort of thing without the high cost on the other end?
Well, a lot of apps are kind of going to what they call this freemium model, you know, where you get the app for free or for 99 cents. But, you know, if it's a game, for example, to advance to certain levels, you, of course, have to pay money to unlock things or get different tools in your arsenal for whatever game you're playing. So a lot of them kind of are going more towards this in-app purchase. You know, and frankly, there's a lot of value in building something gigantic and hoping that somebody wants to buy it from you down the road. Now, you know, the likelihood of that is, debatable. But I think, you know, there's examples of it everywhere, the amount of value that people place into these things. So it's really a matter of having that idea and the execution of that idea that's going to be what helps make you successful.
And presumably, you know, the distribution costs have basically gone away.
Right. Right. Exactly. There's no boxes that you have to print and no media that you need to print. So it definitely – you know, barriers to entry to being a software developer have all but gone away. You know, you pay, I think, $100 to Apple, you pay, you know, whatever to Google, and you're able to be a player in the market.
Is the sky the limit for the app brewery right now? Are you able to you said you've grown from 4 to 12 employees. Mm-hmm. How much more growing can you do?
Well, Chancellor Lovell likes to say that he'd love to see 100 students in the lab. I haven't figured out if he's messing with me or not. But you know, obviously we are trying to be, you know, purposeful in our growth and taking on projects that we can do. You know, we don't want to get in over our heads because, again, this is about providing opportunities for the students. But so long as there's students that are passionate and interested in learning about this sort of work, we'll take them on and we'll show them. So we'd love to see it continue to grow.
Well, Michael Hostad, thank you so much for sharing the story of the app brewery.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Michael Hostad is Director of Web and Mobile Services at UW-Milwaukee. There is a link to more about the app brewery at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. How did Door County's iconic cherry trees weather the long winter? And what's in store for the summer? We'll find out when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. It's early May, and most of the Milwaukee area's trees have yet to come to full bloom. Ditto in Door County, where the cherry blossoms are anxiously awaited, both for their beauty and for their significance to the place's economy. With the summer travel season still a few weeks away, we decided to check in to see how Door County weathered the long winter. John Jarsh directs communications for the Door County Visitors Bureau, and he's with us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.
So how is this year's long and potentially still ongoing winter impacting Door County? As we look around Milwaukee, the trees are still pretty bare. I can't imagine things are going any faster up north.
We still have a little bit of ice out on the bay, but for the most part, it's gone now. And, the weather that we've had will push the blossoms back a little bit this year. But, you know, every year you just never know what the weather is going to bring. It can be early. It can be a little later. Typically, if you look back over history, you're looking at that mid to late May time frame, and that's probably what we're looking at this year for blossoms. Looking like probably a Memorial Day weekend they may start, and then that last week of May is probably when they're going to be at their peak.
What about in terms of the impact that the cold weather and the I don't know what the total snow level was in Door County, but there's certainly a lot down here. Does that spell good things for the cherry crop?
Yeah, in general, the weather this past winter didn't hurt our cherry crop really. I mean, those trees are used to pretty harsh winters, and you know, as long as they don't wake up too early in the year, that cold weather doesn't really impact them, and so they kind of lay low. And that's one of the things about Door County that makes it such a great area for cherries is that we're surrounded by water, and so that water actually helps to temperate the climate a little bit, and that's one of the reasons why cherries have grown so well up there over the years.
We'll talk about the state of things up there right now. Is this, to borrow a metaphor from the winter, is this the calm before the storm?
Yeah, it's an exciting time of year up there right now. You know, the seasonal businesses are dusting things off and getting ready to open up for the season. The year-round places are anxious to get things rolling too. And events, our weekend events are really getting started here. And throughout the month of May now, we've got stuff going on. And yeah, as we ramp up towards Memorial Day weekend and full steam ahead.
Well, and I want to talk about some of the events on the calendar in just a minute. But let's talk about cherries again. I mean, we know cherries are a big deal in Door County, but can you quantify just what a big deal they are?
I would be happy to. We've got right now about 2,500 acres of cherries. So on average, we will harvest about 8 to 12 million pounds of cherries. Those cherries typically are the tart variety, and more often than not, the Mount Morenci specifically variety. So that's what that's the kind of cherry that you use in baking and recipes and all sorts of things. The sweet cherries that we have, we've got about 50 acres of sweet cherries. Those primarily are only – you can only really do one thing with those, and that's eat them. And so
these would be the cherries you'd find in a bowl on your table.
Yes. And so typically those are just gone right from the, you know, from the tree to the farm market or what have you and eaten fresh.
Well, and so presumably this is a pretty significant part of the economy, both from a cherry industry standpoint, but also from a tourism industry standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. The visitors certainly come on up to Door County, and there's a history of folks coming up with their families to pick cherries. While a majority of the cherries now are mechanically harvested because they just have to be, there's still a lot of opportunities for pick your own. You pick your own pail or what have you. And just an exciting time of the year and fun to see families out there with their kids picking cherries.
How has tourism held up in recent years?
You know, we've been pretty fortunate in Door County. It maybe didn't grow as much as we otherwise may have without the recession, but we've kind of held our own, and I think we've seen a decent growth last year. And this year, advanced reservations are looking really positive. I think there's just a lot of pent-up demand with people wanting to travel, and Door County is so close to home, and yet it feels like a world away.
Well, and so you mentioned the idea of pick your own cherries and the appeal of families doing this and kids getting a chance to pick the cherries. But talk about how else cherry tourism plays out.
Well, there's a number of opportunities to experience our cherries. In the springtime, for example, there's a cherry blossom tour that the Door County Trolley offers. And there's other things. For example, in May, there's the Blossom Run. And, of course, during the harvest season, we've got things like a Cherry Fest in Jacksonport. There's a couple
and
of
remind
the—
Remind us, harvest season is—
harvest season typically is mid to late July into early to mid-August. Typically, the cherry harvest happens about 60 days after petal drop. What that means is once the blossoms are there and they actually fall off the trees, it's usually about 60 days until the cherries are ready to actually pick.
So for people who really want to be there for the harvest season, you want to pay close attention to when the petals were out.
Yeah, and we actually have on our website, doorcounty.com/cherries, a great little cherry updater. A blossom report to let folks know when the blossoms are, and also an updater to let them know how the cherry crop is moving along and, of course, when it's ready.
The other aspect to cherry tourism would be the wineries that exist.
Yes. Our wineries and even local distilleries have done a great job at incorporating local Door County cherries into their products. Some great cherry wines. Local distillery, Door County Distillery, has a great Door County cherry flavored vodka that is quite tasty. They're relatively just a couple of years old, so they're doing their thing. And of course, all over the county at different farm markets and different places, you'll find cherry products galore, whether it's just straight tart cherry juice, which has a whole bunch of health benefits, but, cherry jams, cherry salsas, dried cherries. I mean, the list goes on and on. Pretty much anything you can dream up as far as a consumable, you'll find it with Door County cherries in it up there.
Well, and presumably it also drives recipes at restaurants and bed and breakfasts and such.
Yes, absolutely. Some of our more well-known recipes, the White Gull Inn, more famously won the Best Breakfast in America contest a couple of years back on ABC's Good Morning America with their Door County Cherry Stuffed French Toast, which is delicious, I might add. And there's a number of restaurants that incorporate cherries in a whole bunch of different recipes.
Do you track where the most visitors to Door County come from? I mean, I think people in the Milwaukee area experience this on a fairly routine basis on weekends, the steady stream of cars from Chicago who are driving through on their way to Door County. Does the Midwest and do Illinois and Wisconsin really drive tourism there?
Yeah, really, Wisconsin and Illinois, northern Illinois primarily, are our two biggest markets. Of course, southeast Wisconsin is a huge market for us, as is Chicago. But yes, lots of folks come on up. And it's such an easy drive now. It's really four lanes all the way up to Sturgeon Bay. And a quick, easy drive. And again, once you're up there, there's just so many different things to see and do.
What are the other early attractions on the tour? tourism calendar?
Well, we've got in May, of course, just some great activities. Memorial Day weekend with a couple of huge festivals, Mayfest celebration, the Door County Festival of Nature. Sturgeon Bay has their fine art fair. But there's other things, something fun called the Door County Scotty Rally. That's happening in May. The Door County Wine Trail, which is a partnership of all 8 wineries that have a presence in Door County, they have a wine trail weekend, the third weekend in May. So really lots of stuff on the calendar in May. And then, of course, once the summer hits and June comes, really something every weekend, that a big festival or the Lighthouse Festival coming up in early June, Steelbridge Songfest. The list goes on and on. And, of course, all those events can be found online.
Not to have you give away any secrets, but as someone who has been in Door County for a long time, what's the least known but most worth doing part of Door County, maybe off the beaten path?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I could answer that 100 different ways depending on who I'm talking to and their interests. But one of my favorites, I think, has to be, believe it or not, one of our state parks, which are very well known. But it's Rock Island State Park. It's the toughest one to get to in Door County. It actually takes 2 ferry rides to get there. But it's an island. It's the furthest point east in the state of Wisconsin. It has Wisconsin's oldest lighthouse on it, which you can tour. It's about 900 acres, and the whole island itself is a state park. There's no bikes, there's no vehicles allowed, so all you can do is hike and camp. But it is amazing. And that's one of the spots I highly encourage people to get to. It is a journey to get there, but as they say, the journey is the reward.
Absolutely. Well, John Jarsh, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Mitch. Hope to see you in Door County soon.
I hope so. John Jarsh is Director of Communications for the Door County Visitors Bureau. After the break, we'll stick with a cherry theme and meet one of Door County's leading winemakers. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we talked about all things Door County with cherry blossom season on the horizon. John Jarsh mentioned that for many people, one of the region's leading draws is its wine industry. And Door Peninsula Winery is one of the region's leading producers of wines, specializing in fruit wines such as cherry and blackberry. Fruit wines were the draw for winemaker Paul Santariello, who left the wine mecca of Napa Valley to relocate to Door County. He tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce and wine contributor Ray Pfister more about what prompted the move.
I wanted to branch out. I was ready to do my own thing and to take charge of a winery. And what that entails is you're the production manager, the winemaker, the enologist, the chemistry man, blending, organizing labor, picking grapes, fruit, crushing it, making wine. So in a limited way, you could do that in California because you're part of a bigger team. But up here, I'm the head of the team. So it's a good move.
So what did Wisconsin allow you to do that you felt like you couldn't really do in California?
Well, you drop the pretense, maybe just it's a little bit more casual and comfortable here. It's straightforward. And maybe in Napa Valley, there's really a rigidity. There's form structure that we need to maintain in Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot or even Zinfandel. It has to be this way. And I think the farther you get away from that, it just becomes more comfortable, easier. You can think clearer. You're doing your own things. It's fun. It's a relief. It's enlightening.
What did you want to do differently at Door Peninsula Winery than
fruit wines? We've had fruit wines in California. They're not prevalent. They're not all over the place. There's Apple Hill country that has apple and cherry wine. But I think when people go to California wine tasting, they expect the grape wines. And it's the same varietals you see on the supermarket shelf or the liquor store, the restaurant menus. And to do fruit wines, it's the same because you're making wine and the chemistry is involved is the same, but the palate is totally different. And that was my background. It was a laboratory chemistry and blending. And we can achieve a lot of that with fruit wines that you can't with the red wines or white wines because of the rigidity, the structure that they needed to maintain in California winemaking. But now, 10 years later, you look at what's being put on the shelves, and it is a menage of just red wine this, white wine blend that. And Wisconsin's been doing that for 20 years practically.
So you're harvesting grapes as well as other types of fruit. One, does that really extend your harvest season? Two, does that really make it tougher for your labor force?
Yes, because cherries come first, really. The cherry production, apple production happens up north in Wisconsin. It's through a local farm, so I try to source from local farms. So am I driving a shaker or a combine to get all this stuff in? No, I'm not. That's the local farmers that are providing the juice, mm-hmm. and they're picking the fruit. Now, one positive thing about that is we would have, let's say, the cherry harvest come, and instead of crushing the cherries and making a traditional cherry wine, and then we have an end product of cherries that are spent. They're done with their life. You know, they've mm-hmm. been through the winemaking process, and you have to crush them and mulch them. What we do instead, especially in Door County, is we dry cherries. But during the drying process here, you have juice that is coming off. And so as a consequence, we ferment the juice and they dry the cherries and there's really no waste.
So do you end up recycling or does this become sellable dried fruit? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's dried cherries that you would find in the supermarket or anywhere else.
Oh, that's great.
Absolutely.
So it has a full route, I mean, beginning to end.
Yeah. And then the apple harvest comes in right around the grape harvest. And as a result, you have a bunch of apples that are on the fresh fruit market. Mm-hmm. As those don't sell in those first couple critical months, what are you going to do with the bushels of apples that you have hanging out in the barn? And you crush them and make wine out of them.
The interesting thing for me, again, just knowing harvest as I do, for you, that's got to be really rough because you've got all these different periods. I mean, it's not just whites and or Zins coming in at one time and you know, cab coming in at a different time. You've got apples. You've got cherries. You work a lot of hours, I'm guessing.
See, and that was one of the things that drew me to this job is harvest in California happens once a year. So 30-year veteran of harvest, you have 30 harvests under your belt and you've been in the wine industry for 30 years. I'm always fermenting wine. I've been here for 10 years, and that's not just 10 harvests. I have, at any one time, probably adding 4,000 to 5,000 gallons a month just in fermentations.
Wow.
And then in the peak season, even more than that. We increase hours in the summertime because that's really we're getting ready. We're bottling all the time. We can take in fresh juice all of the time. So I kind of have scheduled it to spread it out throughout the year. It just helps with production in that way.
What can people expect from the different fruit wines that you're producing? How are they different from those traditional wines that you were talking about that come out of Napa Valley?
First of all, grape is a perfect fruit for fermentation and making wine because when it is ripe, it makes 12 to 14% alcohol wine. So that's a perfect fruit. Cherries are ripe, and if you actually ferment it, it'll only make maybe a 6 to 7% alcohol wine. So the government allows you to add sugar to the primary fermentation to build it up to a table wine status. And that makes it a non-standard wine. And that's why fruit wines are categorized different from grape wines completely. You know, they're looked at differently. And I think there's some bias there right away. And that's, I think, what you're getting at. But when we look at things like Merlot, and everybody wants to describe what a Merlot tastes like, they're talking plums. Cherry. It has maybe a blackberry or red currant flavor, something like that. And all these descriptors are in grape wines. Well, if you want to have a cherry wine, you have to drink a cherry wine. If you want the apple fruitiness in a Chardonnay, well, you would just drink an apple wine. And we have a lot of cross blends in between there. Cranberry apple has been made now for 25 years at the winery. You know, we've been in business for 40 years, and it started with the apple and cherry harvest in Wisconsin, and cranberries followed shortly after that. So, yeah, I think there is a little bias. People like their grape wine. It is a fine wine experience. I think, you know, we were talking about investigation and being curious about other products, and I think you have to look at fruit wines in that way.
Do you think that attitude maybe is changing, given especially here in Wisconsin, where fruit wines have been produced for so long?
Yeah, one of the things that I realized when I drove into Wisconsin for the first time on my way up to Door County is I didn't see any vineyards. Now, that is to say that from California, practically the whole state is wine country. You drive down the highway, there's all of a sudden vineyards, 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 especially along the 101 along the coast. Into Wisconsin, it's more of a farming community. Beer has been here forever. Spirits before that. And I think the lack of vineyards and the lack of table wine from far a long time ago has kind of limited the idea of wine in Wisconsin.
If you look close, you'll see a lot of beer growing along the sides of the freeway.
You will see a lot of beer growing. And that's my point, is I think the products have been shifted to beer and spirits primarily. Well, wine is, as a nationwide, we are drinking more wine. And I think it is catching on, and it's catching on in Wisconsin. That's why we're opening quite a few wineries a year.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit more about Door Peninsula and, you know, what we would see if we went up there.
Yeah, Door Peninsula Winery is open year-round. It's still in a farming community. The Ag Research Station from UW-Madison is located in the peninsula. And it's just a beautiful microclimate of Wisconsin. It has everything, I think, that's good about the state is in there.
You were talking before about one of the benefits of fruit wine is you know generally from the fruit that's being used to make it, you know what it's going to taste like. Does that make it easier for consumers to be able to pick one of Door Peninsula Winery's wines and pair it with a meal that they're presenting or know what to present to friends at a party?
Oh, for sure. If you have a fruit wine, you know what you can expect. These are more social wines. These are more experimental wines. You should try them like we were talking about pairing food. We see more and more of the spicy foods that are coming into the United States and people are eating more different foods from different lands. And we find that sweeter wines pair with those kind of spicier foods or heavy in some kind of a spice or an element like vinegar. Anything that's really off-putting, a fruit wine will be sweet enough to balance it. So, for instance, like mustards, the mustard has a salty and it's vinegary and it has some kind of character that would kind of make the wine out of balance if it was a dry oak-aged wine. And it would just kind of strike a different, you know, maybe it doesn't taste so good. The fruit wine has some structure there and some sweetness and it's got a fruit note, whether it's cherry, apple, cranberry, whatever, blackberry, whatever you like is what you should be drinking. But it'll pair with the food just fine. It's what I'm finding. And there's certain foods that it works great with. So I think it's still an experiment.
Is that what you were looking for when you came back to Wisconsin, was this room to experiment?
Yeah, it's an experimentation. That's what I love. That's what winemaking is. You have to be kind of a child at play when you're at the winery.
I was thinking mad scientist, but
yeah, you have to be a mad scientist child at play. You have to understand what your working material is and then run away with it and do something with it that no one else can think about doing. For our 40th anniversary, we're going to release some dry fruit wines. And they're going to be cherry and apple. There's no residual sugar. And I've actually barrel aged them. So I think what people are thinking about fruit wines, I'm going to try to turn that on the head. And they're not going to know what fruit wine is. They're going to think they know what fruit wine is. Maybe it's a sweet or it's just, you know, not for me. Well, try this. You know, the apple wine starts tasting a little bit like Chardonnay. And the cherry wine, the cherry really comes out a lot more once it hits French oak. So we're seeing a lot of these new experiments coming out of Door Peninsula, and we'll see.
That should
be
like really interesting.
It's very good stuff.
Yeah. I think tasting these wines on a blind tasting will be a lot of fun too, because you don't see the label, you don't know, and you could put it there, and nobody's going to know what it is. They're going to be forced to be honest when it's in a bag, if it's in a decanter, you don't know.
You don't know, and that's how they judge these things. You know, when we win awards and medals. It's a blind tasting, and we just won a double gold medal with the cherry wine in the Finger Lakes. So,
oh, Finger Lakes, wow.
So, yeah, to get an award like that, you know, look at those kind of things when you're making these selections on what are people winning? What's tasting good right now?
Do you think Fruit Wine's time has happened yet? Do you think it's about to happen?
I think so. I think people are much more open to trying, especially local. You're trying a local product. Yes, it's sweet. And that was one of the ideas I had with the dry wines. You know, you get some pushback, like we were talking about. So, you know, it's a status thing, or maybe they feel it's unsophisticated, which it's not. I think people are really interested in trying new things. Nationally, they're interested in trying new things.
And so what's next for Door Peninsula? What else is going on in your mad scientist lab?
Well, you know, besides the fruit wines, we have grape wines. We do the traditional and important varieties, like a Riesling, one of the noble grapes. I mentioned before Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay. I think all of those have a place at a winery, and so we do very small batches of those things, just like the dried oak-aged fruit wines that are going to be released. I think those are the more important projects for me right now. The blackberry wines are outstanding and really fun to make, but it's the experimentation and the minutiae that's driving the winery right now.
Well, Paul Santariello, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about Door Peninsula Winery.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was great.
Paul Santariello is the winemaker at the award-winning Door Peninsula Winery in Door County. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce and Lake Effect wine contributor Ray Pfister. As you listen to Tommy James and the Shondells, there's more of Lake Effect after this break on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Oh, sweet cherry wine, solary wine. But drink it right now, pass it all around. Toast in your lake, toast out again. Sweet cherry wine.
It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Time now for our weekly segment, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie with the Islands of Milwaukee. We're continuing to explore the sounds of Milwaukee, and this week we have some helpers. We've been working closely with the Goodwill programs that deliver meals to seniors in their homes. The meal delivery drivers we've encountered are a fun, lively bunch.
I'm Diane Kongshug, and I drive the getaway car.
My name is Dwayne Kongshug. I'm a driver out of Beulah, Britain. I've been with drivers for about a year and a half, maybe.
Hi, my name is Pat Sprung. I've been working with the Meals on Wheels for 20 years now, and I love it because you have so many grandmas and grandpas and aunts and uncles. I have a client named Max or Maxine, and the question of the day was, what is the most beautiful sound in the world? And she said to me, I know exactly what you're going to say. And I said, what was that, Max? And she said, you're going to say the sound of a crying baby after it's been born. And I said, no, I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I enjoy the sound of taps played on bugle.
Here are a few more answers that the drivers found.
The most beautiful sound in the world, the ripple of $100 bills.
Record player playing Chet Atkins.
The other one was my cat purring on my lap.
These drivers are navigating between homes that might otherwise be isolated. They are great, quiet connectors of the city. We have more questions of the day to be answered, and we would love to hear from you. We would love for you to take these questions to family, neighbors, or friends. Visit our website, call our islands line, help us uncover some of the secret stories of the seniors of Milwaukee. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. You don't have to be a parent to understand how much pressure parenthood can be sometimes. That pressure comes from all directions, but as Lake Effect essayist Lane Pierce knows, sometimes the worst pressure can be self-inflicted.
When I'm out and about with my 2-year-old son, it's nearly impossible to avoid conversation with strangers. Maybe it's his wavy auburn hair, wide brown eyes, or how he smiles at people straight in the face. When toddlers are in their happy place, they delight in themselves and everything that's around them. It's simply impossible for passersby not to join in the fun. This week, my little one was trotting around the lobby of our local library after his beloved story time with Miss Katie. A woman, moving quickly, prepared herself to blast into the fresh air, but stopped when she saw my son hopping around the lobby's floor mats. "It's been a long time since my boys were this little," she said kindly. "They're practically grown, 17 and 12. My oldest will be leaving for college soon." I said that I could hardly imagine that. "Yes, when they're this little, it's hard to see anything else," she said, looking down at my son. "It can be tough at the beginning with boys," she recalled. "The first 3 years are hard. They have so much energy. It can really take it out of you. But I think when they get older, it seems easier than raising girls." I replied that I'd heard other people say the same thing. She seemed like a relatively open book, so I asked her, "Did you like spacing your children?" She said it wasn't really her plan, but after delivering her first, she got pretty sick. She said she needed a break. Then her dream job popped up and she just couldn't say no. She looked up, 4 years had passed. She was older when she started everything, almost 40 when she had her second. She told me that her youngest was born with a cleft lip and some special needs, and she worried she should have done everything sooner. She looked at me and said, "Until you have a child with special needs, you just can't understand what it takes." I nodded my head slightly. "Yes," I said. We said our goodbyes and she left, but for the rest of the day, I couldn't stop thinking of her. I felt sad thinking of the guilt she was carrying, had carried for all those years. I wished I could find her again to look in her eyes and say, "It's not your fault. It's not your fault your son has disabilities. It's not your fault you needed to take care of yourself. It's not your fault you waited and lived your life and worked a dream job. Don't blame yourself." It takes nearly everything we have to live our own lives. And when we become mothers and have our babies, we dip so far into our reserves that sometimes we come inside out. When things go wrong, we blame ourselves at the cellular level because we think our children perfect. And the only explanation that they could be anything other than perfect must be our own shortcomings. Of course, this isn't true. One of the greatest lessons many of us will need to learn is that we can't be responsible for every breath, feeling, and action our children take. But sometimes it seems so impossible that we could grow our babies inside our very being and not feel accountable for every single thing. The only way I can make sense of this and not be buried under the responsibility of another life is to think of every life, even my child's, as a mystical formula. A formula comprised of choices, circumstances, genes and influences, people, chemistry, traits, grace-filled moments, and a final ingredient that I just can't put my finger on. It's something that changes the equation moment to moment. We mothers are bestowed these lives that sync up to us and change our very stride. All we can do is embrace them and take our steps side by side.
Lake Effect essayist Lane Pierce is a Listen to Your Mother essayist and 2014 Milwaukee cast member. She writes, wrangles, and raises a spirited toddler with her husband in Whitefish Bay. Thanks for listening to Monday's edition of Lake Effect. Don't forget, you can learn more about Lane Pierce and all our other contributors at our website. Go to WUWM.com and click on the Lake Effect tab and pick Contributors. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.